Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Airport Club. Make travel effortless with lounge access, stress-free parking, fast-track security and exclusive duty-free savings.
Good morning. And lo, it begins. Fair to say, it did kick off with quite the bang.
Ivan Yates, good morning.
Ooh, a good get. And they were off.
Simple question to start. You made numerous media appearances commenting on the presidential election. Why didn't you disclose the fact that you had given media training to one of the candidates, Jim Gavin?
Straightforward question, straightforward answer. When I set up, so I left full-time broadcasting in July 2020. When I set up this, amongst other businesses that I've set up in relation to public affairs and coaching, I had a golden rule, and that was client confidentiality. And in the same way, if you're an accountant or a solicitor or communications coach, or Catherine Connolly would never reveal who her barrister clients were. So this is an established, and in my view, is an absolute principle of client confidentiality. So if Fianna Fáil wanted to talk about it, fine, I'm not going to talk about
that. Okay, so you had a duty of care to your clients not to reveal anything about them, the client confidentiality. You should not have a duty of care to your audience. When you are making pontifications about the presidential election campaign, if we take the situation with Matt Cooper, for instance, he's described this as a breach of trust to your audience on Path to Power and the broader public. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. I don't, because in the same way as I give an opinion, say you had me in to talk about Galway West and I said Noel Thomas is going to win, just for a hypothetical example of independent Ireland. That is actually my opinion at that moment in time. If I give an opinion on the government and say their current spending is too high, they're not handling migration well, I rely on my personal...
Is Noel Thomas a client of yours?
Not at all.
Is there not a difference?
No, sorry. What I'm trying to say is, and assert here, is that everyone knows that I have opinions on everything from Trump to anti-woke to nanny statism. A lot of people don't like those views. But by simply doing a coaching role with someone, that I'd be beholden to them, or it would affect my personal... And can I just explain about the coaching?
Well, we'll come on to that in a minute.
When you know that they will. And over the course of about 25 minutes, Ivan Yates and David McCullough went back and forth on who knew what when.
Just to be completely clear, did Matt or anyone else on the podcast ask you if you were working for any of the campaigns?
No, not that I recall. Not that I recall. But either way...
Not that I recall.
No, sorry. The situation is that... The answer is no, as far as I'm concerned, to my best memory. But the truth of it is that if they had explicitly asked me about any of the connections, because as you may have seen with Colin Keane in the Irish Times, I have other interests, business interests, my own companies. I'm involved in building houses in Middleton. I'm involved in issues for wind farms and so on. And all of that, and let's be clear about this, I am absolutely compliant with taxes, with CRO, and with lobbying.ie.
Okay.
And you know what? I have a couple of morals of my own because everyone's lecturing me about my morals. One, I don't tell lies. And secondly, everything I do, I ask the simple question, is this legal? And in the case of the podcast, I asked myself that question.
Okay.
And do you know what the answer is? The 2009 Broadcasting Acts do not cover podcasts. And in fact, the only law covering podcasts, because they're a personal and private expression, is the law of defamation. And similarly, there is no register of interest in News Talk. Now, I'm happy to deal with the Pat Kenny show as well.
Oh, yeah, well, we'll be dealing with that in a moment. Before we do that...
Oh, don't doubt you for a second. But what about those timelines?
So you gave Jim Gavin media training on September 23rd and 29th, as you've said.
As Fianna Fáil has said.
Yeah. You guest presented the Pat Kenny show on News Talk on September 23rd, before you gave the training, the 24th, after you gave the training, and the 25th. And on that programme, September 24th, when a guest said Mr. Gavin lacked charisma, you said, the public don't really know him yet. But you knew him, because you'd just been giving him training. Do you not think the listeners deserved to know
about
that?
I spent 1 hour with him. And basically, and I really don't want to...
You knew about whether he had charisma or not.
No, so the situation is... And I would have made... And that brings us on to Smear the Bejesus. Can we go on?
No. I want to keep you on this.
Well, you will deal with Smear the...
Oh, I will. Don't you worry.
Okay.
Now, You may feel that you're completely in the clear here, that you're it's morally fair that...
I'm relying on my personal integrity to separate my opinion and my work on
podcast.
Are you
familiar with Commission Yaman?
What?
Commission Yaman.
Yes.
The Code of Fairness, Objectivity and Impartiality in News and Current Affairs.
And can I say on that that I have been invited on the 19th of November to appear before Alan Kelly's Media Committee?
Yes.
And I will be there.
Okay.
And I have absolutely nothing
to
hide.
That really wasn't the question.
Sorry.
It says that each broadcaster must put in place and implement appropriate policies and procedures to address any conflicts of interest that may exist or arise in respect of anyone with an editorial involvement in any news or current affairs
and
content.
And who's that obligation on?
It's on News Talk. Telling me now? I'm not trying to have a go at News Talk.
Yeah, well, maybe you are, but the
well,
point
no,
is this.
I'm not. I'm trying to have a go at you.
No, sir. The point is this. There is a couple of pylons here. There's an internal leadership war in Fianna Fáil. There's tensions between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. And there's a bit of an RTÉ pylon in News Talk. And you know what? You know what? If it's the case that Commission na mBan decide that every media organisation broadcast has the same register on a statutory footing as RTÉF, that may well be the outcome. But as of now, that's not the case. And in fairness to News Talk, their governance is compliant with Commission na mBan. But like, let's.
Well, that's for Commission na mBan.
Absolutely.
And this was how the interview finished up.
The fact of the matter is, I'm a pretty, put it like this, you know yourself with any guest, you don't want a bland, boring six of one and a half dozen of the other. But look, let's be fair about this, David. I got more publicity last week than DJ Carey for doing what? If you go on my LinkedIn profile, second item, media trainer, for doing my job, I was treated like a criminal. And to be honest with you, it didn't actually cost me a thought. But last Saturday night, I was live on television doing the Greyhound final for Virgin Media Radio in Cork, and there was about 2,500 people there. The amount of people who came up to me and said, "What a load of nonsense. The media is so obsessed with themselves." People outside the Beltway, you know what the Beltway is? Outside the bubble, regard this as a bottle of smoke.
Okay. Do you think your reputation will recover or has it been damaged?
Well, I'll put it like this. I may have an extra chapter in the book, but the reality of it is I'm pretty robust and resilient. I'm not cocky about it, but I'm saying absolutely adamantly, I broke no rules, and in my mind, I've done nothing wrong, and any coaching job I have has not compromised my own opinions.
Okay, Ivan Yates
with David McCullough, because nobody wants a bland and boring guest. And of course, McCullough's chops as an attack dog, never in question. But then it was on to kind of, well, business as usual. Here he is with parenting expert David Coleman.
I suspect a lot of parents are going to relate to the next one, the power struggle over the soother. Okay, our daughter recently turned 4. She was a colicky baby, so we introduced a soother. Unfortunately, this is still in our life. And while we have talked about saying goodbye to Dodo at length, there is much resistance.
Resistance to the Dodo, all grand. And then finance expert Owen McGee, well, he was asking for a friend.
Say, for instance, you were a radio presenter and you worked in the office in the mornings, but you had a certain amount of work to do in the evenings at home. Could you claim anything for that?
You wouldn't be required to work in the evenings.
No,
you?
This is purely hypothetical.
Everyone knows you got home at 11 o'clock and you're in the golf course by 12. No, so what I would say is this is the pro rata thing. This is about making sure. What I would always say when it comes to taxes, you need to be able to stand over. We talked about it at the very start. This is about being fair to society, right? You need to be able to stand over what you're claiming. And if you feel it's fair and you're unsure, ring Revenue and ask them, is this the right way to do it? And what I would say is that sounds reasonable to me. If half your time is at home and half your time is in the office, that's fair too.
Okay, I want to get to some of the listeners.
Well, that's 9 to 11 out the door with their lunchbox. But what about Oliver? Maybe getting the benefit of a short lie-in?
David Kilkenny is also saying he doesn't know what time it is either. This late start is bananas. Yes, David, but this is reality now.
Bringing us to Kieran Cuddy.
Yes, good afternoon. You are very, very welcome to Liveline here on RTÉ Radio 1. 0818 715 815 it's still the number. I mean, they haven't changed everything. 51551 is the number for your...
When he was getting right into it. More on that later. And of course, the mighty Louise, now at 3.
Are we ready for the music for all of the glorious tunes I will play between now and 4 p.m. from Eddie Vedder to Fontaines DC, the Velvet Underground and Stevie Nicks and a whole lot.
Oh, and then a new drive time with Colm and Katie at the helm into a full hour of sport with Jackie Hurley and Marie Crowe.
Inside Sport at 6 o'clock this evening. The other new kid.
I'm jealous that you're nearly finished and I'm just starting. So
yeah, no, Mammy's coming to collect us on our first day now. We get to go home.
It's passing the baton now.
That's it, yeah.
Ooh, well, you might be double checking yourself for a few days, but embracing it, we are. And hard as it might be to believe, me, myself and I, the week did have some other bits of not insignificant news. There was that little matter of Catherine Connolly being sworn in as president.
Wet old morning, Barry. What's going on there?
Yes, Falsha Gudi, Kashlan Balya, Oha Clea, Aaron Law, Starul, Shud David. In the past few minutes, we've seen the final rehearsals take place here in the courtyard from the Army Composite Band and some of the 250 members of the Defence Forces involved in today's proceedings. Final rehearsals ahead of Catherine Connolly, set to become the 10th Uachtaráin na hÉireann sometime around lunchtime. And this really the sequel to the presidential election. It is the most ceremonial day in Irish politics, in the Irish state, with the presence of all the pillars of the state, a day full of colour and splendour. This, the 15th inauguration since Douglas Hyde became president in 1938, and underlining the significance, the historical significance of today, this will be the first inauguration to involve three former presidents, with both with Mary Robinson, Mary McAleese, and of course Michael D. Higgins set to be in attendance. As I say, preparations continuing right up until the last minute. We've seen the chandeliers in St. Patrick's Hall cleaned very carefully. 127 kilograms, one of those chandeliers weighs. The carpets have been cleaned. The windows only cleaned yesterday to avoid any last minute deposits from rogue seagulls. The flowers have been ordered. The plastic is still on the red carpet in the courtyard, whilst the chair upon which Catherine Connolly will sit, it will return to the chair used the initial inauguration in 1938, this initially a throne for Britain's Queen Victoria on her visit in 1849. It has been re-gilded and re-upholstered with extra linen supplied to tuck in the horsehair in the chair, which actually dates back 200 years.
Oh, the marigolds were on. And with Oliver, this man coaxed out of retirement for one last gig.
She is wearing an outfit that's been designed by Louise Kennedy.
This is something you've discovered.
Well, I just made a few calls and I'm afraid I don't know the technical term, but it's purple. I can see that.
It is, yeah.
And it's a full length coat and trousers underneath. And that's interesting because Mary Robinson, for her inauguration, wore purple.
She did.
And at the time...
Also Louise Kennedy.
Also
outfit,
Louise Kennedy.
And it's now in the Collins Barracks where
exactly,
the guns
part of an exhibition, yeah. So, and I think purple is connected with the suffragettes, the movement for votes for women in the early
idea?
Part of the last
That's
century. So I think that was a symbolism of the time that Mary Robinson was seeking to convey. Dublin Castle, the seat for hundreds of years of British rule in Ireland.
Yeah.
St. Patrick's Hall, a venue that's really steeped in the history, that aspect of her history. If the president-elect looks up, she'll see a painting on the ceiling of the coronation of George III. It has that sort of...
That's wonderful symbolism
that history
there,
of
it's kind of reinforcing this independence for most of the country on this kind of particular day. And St. Patrick's, and their flags along either side, they're from the 18th century.
They are the flags of the Order of St. Patrick, which was an order of chivalry that was founded in the 18th century and then went into abeyance, obviously, after independence. But the flags are still there. So all those echoes, if you like, of our history and our past on this momentous day.
And a momentous day it was.
I stand before you humbly and proudly as the 10th president of this beautiful country. The people have spoken and have given their president a powerful mandate to articulate their vision for a new republic. A republic worthy of its name, where everyone is valued and diversity is cherished, where sustainable solutions are urgently implemented, and where a home is a fundamental human right. The change that led to this joyful day began with a small group of elected representatives and volunteers facing what appeared to be insurmountable challenges. We were led to believe that it was too great a leap, that our ideas were too far out, too left, at odds with the prevailing narrative. In shared conversations all over the country, however, it became evident that the dominant narrative did not reflect or represent people's values and concerns. Time and time again, people spoke of how it served to silence, to other, to label, to exclude, and to stifle critical thinking. Along with that, however, along with meaningful engagement, we saw the emergence of hope. We saw the emergence of joy, along with the courage and determination of people to use their voices to shape a country that we can be proud of.
President Catherine Connolly speaking at her inauguration on Tuesday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Thursday, the latest government housing plan was published. And there have been a few.
How many of them have there been? Okay, I'll give you the hit list. Social Housing Strategy was a brilliant, snappy name. Alan Kelly, 2014. Then you had Rebuilding Ireland. That was a good name, I thought. Simon Coveney, 2016. Then he ran away from there. Dara O'Brien, Housing for All. But for Dara O'Brien, it was like, Housing for All! That was 2021. You know the story. Targets weren't met. Things delayed, over budget, criticised by the opposition. Government said it was the crash in COVID and Thierry Henry's handball. Did that happen in the same period? Something like that. So the 2011, we had 7,000 houses built that year. But after only 2 years, it was only 4,500 per year. But they've got it up to 30,000 homes. The developers, that is, they've been finishing them the last 2 years, each of the last 2 years, still well short of what's needed. The new plan out today is promising 60,000 a year. And James Brown, the minister, this is the fourth plan. It's called, wait for it, Delivering Homes, comma, Building Communities. Somebody worked on that title now a long time. It's like they've given up building the houses. They're just building communities now. They're going to be delivering the houses by a fella on the back of a bicycle. And unfortunately for them, now this plan was actually due many months ago. So the actual plan, it was delayed. And anyway.
Oh my, very cynical. But let's hear what's in the plan. Housing Minister James Brown came into Rachel on the News at One and this was her opening question.
Before we get into some of the detail, given the catalogue of failures on housing, why should anyone listening believe that this time is different?
Because this plan is very much focused. It's focused on delivering the homes that people need right across the country. We have seen a step change in housing delivery over the last 4 years. Housing for All has delivered a significant increase in homes from 20,000 a year to 30,000 a year. But our population has been increasing. The needs of our population is changing. And that's why we have to make a further step change to deliver the number of homes we need right across 10 years for all types of people who need the homes. And that's what this really is about. It's very much focused on that. And for example, we've €1 billion in there for infrastructure fund to address the blockages in terms of activating housing on the ground. We have the Housing Activation Office going from local authority to local authority, seeing where those blockages are. The LDA with an additional €2.5 billion to deliver homes at scale right across the country as well. And then very targeted measures for homelessness in the country as well. We want to end homelessness. I believe we can make a huge effort towards working towards ending homelessness, but we also want to exit those people in homelessness at the moment as well. So it's a very targeted plan to really activate housing. We've had big policy decisions made over the last number of years. This is really now getting into the granular about unlocking the housing delivery, both social, affordable and also private home delivery in this country.
You mentioned targets several times there. One thing this document doesn't have is annual targets for new homes. Is this because the government was so badly stung by missing last year's target?
No, when the government exceeded its targets, it was also criticised for not having higher targets. I think targets can become very much a distraction and an end in and of itself. We have the government's target of 300,000 homes to be delivered over the lifetime of this plan. So that is there. The output, if you like, the completions every year will be, that data will be out there for the public to see and for the media to see as well as commencements and planning applications. So all the data will still be there, but I am totally results driven. I am all about activating housing delivery as much as possible. We have delivered over 80,000 homes a year in the past. I believe we can dramatically increase home delivery, but it is all about those activation measures.
From the News at One, and as you might expect, Sinn Féin housing spokesperson Eoin Óibrín, less than impressed. He spoke to Colm on Drive Time.
Just to clarify, what are your own targets? Because just adding up the figures on your site of 75,000 social, 50,000 affordable, 115,000 private purchase and 60,000 rental or self-build adds up to 300,000. So what additional would you put on that then?
So the full five-year plan that we have published requires an average of 60,000 new homes every year. So that's 20% more than the government's. But what's also really important is within that you have to build the right kinds of homes. And what's very, very significant about today's plan is that they have not changed the targets for delivery of social, affordable rental or affordable purchase homes. They remain exactly the same as they were in Dara O'Brien's plan. And that means, for example, that those people who are trapped in homelessness, languishing on local authority housing waiting lists, stuck in an expensive and insecure private rental sector or desperate to own their own home, nothing is going to improve for those people, and as a consequence, house prices, rents and homelessness will continue to rise. That's the reason why the government have done away with the annual figures. It's not about the global figure. Government used to also give us, from Simon Coveney's time in 2016, right up until Dara O'Brien's plan, annual targets for the delivery of new built social homes, of affordable purchase homes, of cost rental homes. They're actually the targets that they miss every year and miss badly. And the reason why they're not publishing targets is because they don't want to, or they want to try and conceal the fact that they're going to continue to miss those targets in the years ahead.
Eoin Óibrín on Drive Time. But let's leave that one there for now. Going instead here, Lifeline, their opening call on Monday.
Annette from Carrigan Challenge joins us now. Annette, you got in touch with us here in Lifeline. What happened yesterday?
Well, first of all, Kieran, congratulations on the new post. And I'm sorry to be the first caller and going to have a rant at you. But
that's A-OK.
Yeah, I called an ambulance for my mother yesterday at 1 o'clock. I arrived into Sligo University Hospital at 5 to 2. And my mother wasn't seen or had bloods taken for almost 8 hours after that.
Oh, a wait for sure. But particularly when it would turn out that her mother had sepsis. Quite shocking. And that was how the new Lifeline week kicked off. And they would cover, among other things, yes, A&E waiting times, scooters, labour shortages and the shocking sophistication of some scams.
How much money did you lose?
€18,000.
Okay. 18 grand gone.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the start. Paint a picture for me. You're at home and you're looking for a few extra quid to supplement the pension. Is that right?
That's correct. Absolutely. So I'm online and I'm looking up jobs. I'm not looking for something, you know, too taxing.
Oh, and the clue there might be online. That was Thursday. Well worth a listen back. But we will go to the discussion they had on the flying of the Irish flag. Because at this stage, there'd be few places in the country that haven't seen the tricolour erected on lampposts and all kinds of things. From County Meath, here's Andrea.
These have just arrived up. And if you look at the connotations of what they are, Ireland for the Irish. What is Irish? You know, who are we talking about? So who is it not for then?
What does it mean to be Irish?
Well, I mean, to be Irish, I suppose, and that's a really tough question. But to be Irish is, I mean, you don't have to have been born here. People, you know, they get their citizenship later on. Once you come and you live in a country and you're willing to be part of that country, you want to give something. And everybody who arrives into this country, irrespective of whether they're asylum seekers, whether economic migrants, whatever, they want to give. They want this community. County Meath, we have embraced all cultures together. So I suppose to be Irish is to be welcoming, to be inclusive, to be respectful, to know that actually we shouldn't be putting up barriers against each other. And unfortunately, what we do is when we feel that somehow we're not getting our needs met, and that is true, and I have huge empathy for people because I know there's a housing crisis. I know that mental health services are on the floor. We heard, you know, the situation for children with special needs. It's horrific. But if you visualise tomorrow, and we say anyone who's not Irish by passport, by birth, whatever they want to say. Anyone who we don't see to be fully, you know, white Irish, born here on, you know, bread and butter pudding, whatever we want to call it. If they all decide to leave tomorrow, will those needs still be met? Will we have our houses? No, they will not. Absolutely not. Will crime against women stop? Yeah. Absolutely not.
You'd have to find a new Liveline presenter, Andrea. I wasn't born in this country, actually. So I'd be up and out as well.
There you go. You know, you're gone. That's it. See you now. Because you know what? You're not Irish.
That would be awkward. It's only his first week. But also on the line, this man, Christopher, also, as it happens, from County Meath.
You've got a different view, is that right?
I would have a different view, Kieran. Yeah, I think they're on about the flag. She talked about weaponising the flag, and I think she's actually the one weaponising the flag. And the reason of an Irish flag being associated with racism is it's just fictional, is all it is. We as a nation, the same as any other nation, are entitled to fly our flag.
Mm.
And our Irish flag is a sign of hope. It's a sign of hope to the Irish people who are feeling forgotten about. And when I say Irish people, there's Irish Polish people, there's Irish Brazilian people, there's people from all over the world in Ireland working, living among us, our friends, our families. And if the Irish people were raising Irish flags in a racist manner, we would have been raising them 30, 40 years ago. When you know, like, I'm 45 and I would come from a time where you wouldn't have seen many different colours of people in Ireland. And that, am I racist to say that? I'm not. I'm just telling the truth.
Yeah.
I remember back in the, probably it started in the 90s or so, or it was probably when the building boom came, especially in the agricultural sector. People moved away from working on farms and driving machinery, and they went to the construction. And Brazilian people were brought into this country to service the agricultural industry, from working on farms, whether it was fruit picking or in the meat factories or actually on the ground on farms. And those people, you ask those people or speak to them, have they experienced racism in Ireland? And they have never experienced racism.
And as might have been anticipated, the putting up and indeed the taking down of flags, well, the debate veered a little bit off that one.
It's a totally different situation when people are coming in busloads into towns and nobody knows where they're from, nobody knows anything about them. And hopefully the most of them people will get jobs, will come good and will work with us.
Yeah.
But there's a fear there. And anybody that has an opinion and says, I am nervous and I am afraid of these people because I don't know who they are, is called racist.
Is that true, though, Christopher?
Of course it's true. Absolutely.
That if somebody just says, I'm nervous or I've got questions, that they're called racist.
I'll prove to you how it's racist. Where is the debate? Where is the debate on mainstream media? Where is the debate on RTE or the station that you used to be on?
We're having a debate now.
No. We have people. We have people in this country. We have some fantastic journalists. We have intelligent people who have been literally cancelled because they've come out and said anything that doesn't fit the government script, is what I'd call it.
Yeah,
and
Christopher, I can't speak on behalf of anyone else, but I mean, I've been working in what people would call mainstream media for several years. I've lost count of the amount of debates I've had about migration and flags and IPAS centres and the asylum process. I mean, it's been had all the time. I mean, we're not doing it morning, noon and night,
night. The debate is always between two people that are on the same side, only that they have two different beliefs to it. You never actually bring somebody on, or nobody on mainstream media actually has a proper debate, because the people who would actually just come out and say it would not be brought on to shows. It's actually a miracle I was brought on here, because I had a fair argument with the man who I was speaking to at the start. But we have to go back to the flags.
Ooh, and go back to the flags they did. A debate that could run and run. Kieran Cuddihy on Liveline. But for an insight into the lives of second-generation migrants, we give you Dermot O'Leary.
Is it true you were a fan of Brendan Shine as a kid?
What? Why are you speaking about the past tense?
Your first concert.
I love Brendan Shine.
First do you want your old lobby washed down
country? It was in Chelmsford or Braintree. And that's where really a lot of that identity comes from. I grew up in, my parents came over, lived in London, moved out to Colchester. Pretty small provincial town, but like any small town, there's always, you know, you find your tribe. And there were Irish there through Mass. And Kevin, who was one of the parishioners, ran the local restaurant and local hotel. So suddenly we were able to go there and have the Sunday dinner. So, and then we, my dad never drank, but then we'd be back to ours. And then all the Tommy Makem and the Clancy's and all of that would come on. And then on Monday, I'd go back to a local Church of England primary school.
Yeah.
And then next weekend we'd be up in London and I'd be watching my dad hurling. And then we'd be at Mass in Kilburn and roast dinners and musicals and VHSs around my Auntie Angela's house in Queen's Park. And the sort of big, you know, these Irish families and like the Howlands and used to play for the Father Murphys and all of this. And so that, and then on Monday I'd go back to a Church of England primary school.
Back to England,
so
okay.
It's a really, but that can't.
Did you have friends in both worlds?
Oh, yeah. And that can't possibly not have an impact on you.
So does he feel Irish, British, or maybe something in between?
Like Irishness is a weird thing for someone who's just second generation because it's so subjective that can mean one thing to some people who've got Irish parentage and something totally different. For me, absolutely elemental in my upbringing. For other people I know, they might lean into it a little bit and, you know, and they might appreciate it. But it doesn't define who they are. So it's kind of, you know, no two answers are the same. But that is what mixed heritage looks like, guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I sort of spent a lot of my life wanting to be accepted when I was over here. And I don't really care. I don't really feel like that anymore. I think it's a very different sort of Irish, but it's just as valid as any other.
You don't need the validation anymore.
I mean, I'm on TV. You always need the validation. From the moment you get up, we all need the validation.
The reason it makes headlines here is because we're always very curious about, I suppose, what the British think about us, if they think about us at all. Do you think the British are aware of the conversation you've been having about identity?
Not particularly, but I think having sort of been brought up with a foot in both camps, I would say, well, the British and the English are two different things.
Are they, though?
Oh, yeah. but I'd say both, whether you're British or you're English.
Are you also British, then?
No. But I care deeply about the country, and I love it. And it's not something I'm definitely part of that society, and I adore it. So, but I wouldn't necessarily identify as it. But I never have done. It's never been a conversation that I've had to have with myself, because it's just how I've been brought up. But that doesn't mean that I don't love every fibre of the country. I think it's a great place.
Dermot O'Leary with Oliver. Oh, and if you were thinking of inviting him to a party, not so much disco balls and dance floors. It better be more of a literary salon.
W.B. Yeats is, you quote his poetry on Nights Out. Right?
No, Nights Out with me are fun, man. Like,
The Stolen Child, now at Dermot.
Can I just
quiet
say?
Now, quiet now.
Only when asked.
What like, your English got, friends must
be,
have made.
It's got to be a specific sort of night out. I just go, when I come down the local.
I have some lovely poetry.
You'll hear an Irish airman foresees his death. It's going to be so much banter.
Great crack altogether. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Eating Chilies live on air on your very first programme. What sick puppy thought that was a good idea?
Three different chilies.
Yeah. We have guajillo for colour, which is fruity, medium heat, low. Then we have chipotle for a bit of smokiness and heat. Tiny bit.
That's Lily Foran, a woman who knows her chilies.
Actually, quite spicy.
Okay, here's the taste test now. Here, hang on a second.
And then there has the arbol chilies, which are basically at the same level of bird's eye chilies.
Yeah.
I'll see if I can actually talk through it. So far, it hasn't burnt the throat off me.
My tongue is.
It's a builder.
My tongue is. Okay.
That's a little bit of heat, right? Only a little.
I should hope so. That really could have gone horribly wrong. But thankfully, all survived. And then, sticking with the food theme, they got into the cost of living. And an international, yes, international whip around. Spain, feeling it with this staple.
They had a little bit of good news, I can tell you, recently on olive oil, because that had hit record levels. They were paying what they thought was astronomical, 10 or 12 euros for a 5-litre bottle last year.
Well, bad harvest, was it?
It was a bad harvest, these droughts. But that's gone down 34% because they've had a good harvest. And that, for Spaniards, absolutely crucial.
But in Germany, as Arthur Sullivan told Katie, this is their metric.
I know we talk about the price of a pint here as, you know, as sort of a marker of how things are going on the cost of living front. The doner kebab is what you talk about there in Berlin.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, a bit like the price of a pint, not necessarily the most healthy option, but definitely a staple in the national diet here. It's the most popular sort of, I suppose, street food, if you call it that, or snack. And there is a sort of an informal doner kebab price index that people pay quite close attention to. So just 8 or 9 years ago, again, it's a bit like the price of a pint in Ireland. 8 or 9 years ago, you could get a doner kebab for maybe 3 or 4 euros. And it's a very popular thing because, you know, students could afford it. People on their breaks from work, regardless of what they were doing, could afford it. People might get it after having a few drinks. But now you're looking at 7-8 euro for the price of a doner kebab. So it's gone up by almost 100% in 7-8 years. Right. And so it's really symbolic, I suppose, of that cost of living issue, that something that was associated with being cheap, being quick, being affordable is now actually something that you have to put your hand in your pocket significantly more than you used to have to do.
Kind of consoling. With Oliver yesterday, Blind Boy. He's been nominated as Best Presenter for his documentary, The Land of Slaves and Scholars. And he had a very interesting insight into pomp and ceremony.
I don't like ritual of any description. So here's the thing, whether it be politics, monarchy, religion, the art world, they all use like ritual and spectacle to create this. It creates a sense of inevitability and seriousness, right? But that then hides the fragility of the power. And solemnity, which is the performance of seriousness, underneath it all, it's always something very, very silly. Like even if you take monarchy, like the silliest ritual I saw was when your man who's the king now, Charles, when he became king, and I looked at his ceremony and it was so foolish and silly. But when you strip it down, like what is a king? And a king is I had an ancestor long ago who was profoundly violent. This was a very violent person.
Right.
And now I own everything that he got through violence, and this silly hat that I wear, the ritual around this silly hat and this silly gown, this entitles me to this. It's absolutely absurd. And that's why whenever you see the rituals and solemnity, whether it be religion, military, politics, the art world too, humor often isn't allowed in, because no. When you bring humor into that space, now all of a sudden it's absurd. Everything has to be, like, it's important that we make a distinction between seriousness and solemnity. You can be really serious about something, but also be silly at the same time.
Oh, that's interesting. And he also talked about an ancient greeting that he might like to see brought back.
And Patrick's Confessions, he gives us lovely little insights into Irish culture. My favourite one being the practice of male nipple sucking. Patrick said that when he got onto a boat, that the sailors, when they met each other, they used to suck each other's nipples.
This is in St. Patrick's Confessions.
Yeah, this was a thing in Ireland, was the whatever was going on, instead of shaking hands in ancient Ireland, men sucked each other's nipples. And it appeared to be a power thing.
I'm not sure we can bring that one back.
I'd love to bring it back. I think. But here's the thing. Why can't?
It'd be an interesting inauguration, wouldn't it?
There you go. The nipple sucking thing, you know, 1,000 years ago, that was probably very solemn. Now, if I was to suggest that, why can't Simon Harris have a flap in his suit where another politician sucks his nipple? That's absurd. That's ridiculous. That's preposterous. But I'm just saying, 1,500 years ago, Patrick was going, this is how things were done. This is what the Irish did. And we can see how seriously it was taken, because with bog bodies, when they look up bog bodies that are dug up, these are ritually sacrificed. And something that's quite common with bog bodies is the nipples were cut off.
Right.
So something about nipples, power, kingship. And we can't know, but what some people reckon is that pre-Christian, in Ireland before Christianity, the king was married to the land, and the land was a goddess. And if there was crop failure, if there was bad weather, it was basically blamed on the king. It's like the king did not get the land pregnant. And the nipple might have been some conduit between the land's fertility and the king.
That might make sense.
Why nipples were so important. That's why the bog bodies had their nipples cut off. And that's why Patrick was saying these lads were sucking each other's nipples.
Well, we are experiencing something of a Gaelic resurgence. Double tear you down the pub. Now, if you thought we were going to trot on without mention of the match, not a bit of it, because even Team Playback did soccer on Thursday night. But first, let's go to Inside Sport when Marie Crowe spoke to Niall Quinn way back on Monday. Because let's face it, no one thought we could win this one.
We should be concentrating on finding a way that people get back to not liking to play against Ireland. We're too easy to play against over the last number of years.
Whose fault is that?
Appointing a manager is a big part of it all. And you can get lucky or you can get unlucky, whatever. When I was in the FAI for that short period of time, we came into a situation where Stephen had got the job from Mick. The time ran out for Mick to play the last couple of games, and then Stephen came in and took it over. And anybody who was involved in that process had gone. So this felt the right thing to do, and I was only there for a little while, and I wasn't involved in the international setup per se, was to support Stephen as best we could because that decision was made. And Roy Barrett carried that on. Then to the point when that fizzled out away for Stephen, the new manager came in, tight window to get it right. And you know, most other managers like Jack, they had 2 years. And if it didn't go well, we're probably going to get another run up to the fourth year where there was qualifications to be got second time round. Mick got a second run at it when he was the manager, you know. And so you have to have shown in that period of time that you deserve a second run at it, that your character is strong enough. Have they appointed a man? Did they get it right on that day? I think that's yet to be proven.
Golly, poor Hamer. And expectations for the games, pretty low.
Heroic failure would do at this stage. If we fail heroically in these next two games and there's an identity shown within those games, I think I'd be all for keeping him on.
Niall Quinn on Inside Sport on Monday, but he wasn't alone. Get out your deep dish humble pie.
What's rare is beautiful, and it's great to be wrong. Des Cahill is here. Morning, Des.
Yeah, great to be wrong about fearing Ireland wouldn't win. None of us thought Ireland would win, but they did. They beat Portugal 2-0 with Troy Parrott getting both goals. But despite that and the incredible scenes of celebration, we're still just third in the group. Even if we beat Hungary on Sunday, we won't be in the World Cup. We'll just be in a playoff, but that shouldn't take from our victory.
Ah, Des, should hope not. Let's take the win.
But even if we don't make the World Cup, we'll always have the memories of last night.
Ireland do have this corner in the 17th minute on the far side. It's a good one too to the back post, and it's in the back of the net, and Ireland have scored! Liam Scales put it across the area, and Troy Parrott has got his sixth goal for Ireland. Would you believe it? In the 18th minute, it's Republic of Ireland 1, Portugal 0. We're in dreamland. Here's a chance, and Ireland got a second. Unbelievable! He's done it again. Troy Parrott, just before half-time, and it's Ireland 2, Portugal 0. He's got to send them off, is he?
Yeah, it's a red.
He's gone. Cristiano Ronaldo has been sent off, and he does applause around the ground, and they're all going, boo-hoo, get off yourself. Ronaldo, that's three games in a row, Ireland at home, have had a man sent off against them. And who would have thought it would have been Cristiano Ronaldo?
The noise is fabulous.
It's unreal drama and excitement there.
It's certainly is Morning Ireland. Of course, on Lyric, slightly different take.
Speaking of parrots, not to be confused with two gold wonder Troy, what would you call a parrot in an orange weather warning without an umbrella? Polysaturated.
Oh, Marty. And if the hope doesn't kill you, the jokes will. World Cup is still within our grasp. And now, pundits everywhere in a bit of a quandary. Here's David McCullough with Dermot Corrigan, La Liga correspondent with The Athletic.
Call the result on Sunday.
I think Ireland can do it. I'm kind of trying to be positive again. I was trying to be positive coming up to this game. And Ireland have been through a lot. The team have been through a lot. The fans have been through a lot recently. Hungary are not brilliant. We saw when they came to to Ireland. They can also be good on in parts, but bad in parts. There's weaknesses in their game. So yeah, Ireland, another backs to the wall, maybe another difficult game. A lot of defending for Ireland to do, but in the end, maybe they can nick it 2-1.
Oh, come on, ye boys in green. Now we are almost at a finish, and do forgive us if we've been overly focused on the shake-up. Normal service will resume next week, but musically, too big or clever to play a little bit of Run DMC? I don't think so. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.